All the Rage with John Bowd. On www.traxfm.org.
Hello, listeners. Welcome again to All the Rage. Thank you very much for listening. And this week, I'm very glad to say that we have a guest who's going to talk about a subject that I think is hugely important to the wider world and also happens to be hugely important to me. Guest, could you please introduce yourself, sir?
Hello, my name is Bernard Regan. I'm a trade unionist. I was a teacher. I'm involved in the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, and I've written a book about Palestine called The Balfour Declaration, which is about the beginning of the whole story of Palestine from the point of view of recent events, and it's about the role of the British in particular.
Great. Thank you very much for joining us today. I suppose we'll start on this particular subject with, a combination of history, both relating to the country and personally. So how did you get involved in Palestine solidarity? And what first sparked you to have an interest in that?
I think there were two things that really kind of put Palestine on the map as far as I was concerned. The first of those was that in the late 1960s, I was very involved in campaigns like the Vietnam Solidarity Campaign and the campaign against apartheid in Britain, which were mass organisations that mobilised many young people onto the streets in opposition to American imperialism and in opposition to what was happening in South Africa. And towards the end of that year, I went to a meeting which was organised around the issue of Palestine and Israel in 1968, 1969, around about then, and met for the first time Jewish socialists who had left Israel because of their opposition to the events that were taking place when Israel carried out an invasion and an expansion of its territory. So that was really kind of one of the first issues. And what was interesting was that these were Jewish activists, Israeli activists who had left their country in protest to what was taking place. Moshe Makaba, who some people may have heard of, who was a professor of mathematics and a very prominent political figure in relation to Palestine and in relation to Israel. And I heard him speak together with a Palestinian, Nicola Jabra, and heard from them an account which explained in a critical way what was happening and the events that were taking place. And the other major thing, Jonathan, that happened was in 1982 was the Lebanon War, when Israel invaded South Lebanon in an endeavour to squash the Palestinian uprising which was taking place there. And during the course of that, they attacked two Palestinian refugee camps, Sabra and Shatila. And massacres were carried out there in which estimates vary, but in excess of 1,500, mainly women and children, were massacred. They were actually killed by Christian phalangists from Lebanon. But what happened was that there was a massive demonstration inside Israel itself at the time, with up to 500,000 people involved protesting against what had taken place. And a commission of inquiry was opened up by the Israeli government, which revealed that the Israeli army was entirely complicit in this massacre that had taken place, because they had stood outside at the gates of the refugee camps whilst the fascists, and they were fascists because they took their name, Falange, from the Spanish fascist organization. The Falangists went into those camps and carried out massacres, and it was mainly women and children, because what had happened is that the Palestine Liberation Organization, which was centered in these camps and centered in South Lebanon, had negotiated their departure from Lebanon, and they went to Tunisia, and as a result left behind mainly women, mainly children, and older members, older men, And it was they who were subsequently became the victims. And this was an outrage which had repercussions inside Israel itself, as I've explained, with 500,000 people on the streets and with a commission of inquiry. And this found the then Minister of Defence guilty and responsible for this atrocities that had taken place. And he was Ariel Sharon. And of course, later he went on to become the Prime Minister of Israel. And that had profound effects. And as a result of that, I raised the whole question inside my trade union that I was involved in. And we, along with other trade unions in Britain, called for an international commission of inquiry into the events that had taken place. So those were the two really stark kind of experiences, if you like, at a personal level that made me aware and conscious of what was taking place in Palestine. So obviously after that, then, as you do, I started to try to find out more, to read more and to learn more about it. And subsequently went on to visit Palestine and Israel and to take trade union delegations across.
That's I think that's a really beautifully put answer, because what you've intertwined there is the kind of the personal and the political, you know, a major international event and how you were brought into it. Not least including that happening in a time before we used to regularly use the term globalization. Just for the sake of our audience, if they're not quite familiar with the, if they're a little bit sick of having arguments on social media where someone says it's complicated, what does that mean? So we're starting, let's say, running up to 1948, just before then, when we saw the founding of the State of Israel. What does that actually mean for Palestinian people? As best, that we can actually explain that, even though we are both not Palestinian.
Well, I think one has to begin the story, if you like, of what took place in 1948 in the beginning of the 20th century. That is, in particular, the decision in Britain in 1917 by the British government to give support to the project of creating a Jewish homeland in Palestine, which was initiated by the Zionist organization, which was a political organization, which began in the end of the 19th century. It was an organization which really was responding to two kind of major developments that were taking place. One was the growth of nationalist movements in the 19th century, for example. It was only in the 19th century that Germany was unified, that Italy was unified, and you began to get increasing calls for independence, particularly in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, in the Ottoman Empire and elsewhere. So this was this nationalist development which was taking place. So people seeing, if you like, part of the resolution of the challenges that they faced being the creation of independent nations able to determine their own future. And combined with that was throughout the latter half of the 19th century, particularly in Eastern Europe, profound anti-Semitic developments that took place, pogroms that were carried out, Jewish communities attacked, homes destroyed, livelihoods destroyed, murders taking place, violence taking place against the Jewish communities, murder and rape, and so on. And some of these were really horrendous. And in response to this anti-Semitism, Zionism began as a way of trying to find an answer to this challenge. But it was not the case that within the Jewish community as a whole, there was unanimity about what that would mean. There were those who wished to have a homeland anywhere in the world where there was territory that they could control and develop independently. There were those who very much saw Palestine as the only destination for the creation of a homeland. And yet there were others who were of a more religious inclination, who simply wanted some kind of spiritual focus, if you like, in Palestine, not the creation of a state, but a religious focus. And indeed, of course, there are many Orthodox Jews who took the view that it was not their right to establish a state. It was a matter for God to determine when Jews would have a homeland, and therefore they shouldn't take any initiatives to do that. That's still reflected today in even in Israel, but also across the world, there are Orthodox Jews who are very strongly, very firmly anti-Zionist. They believe that there should not be a state, that it's not the right of Jews to do that. So that was one development that took place. The second really was that this coincided with Britain's preoccupation, the British British government's preoccupations at the time. And I think you could probably summarise those as three central things. The British Empire was huge. I mean, we think today in terms of the United States of America and its reach and its kind of control of developments in different parts of the world. But the British Empire was the largest empire that has ever been created. It covered a quarter of the world's land surface. It covered virtually a quarter of the world's population. It was absolutely huge. And it's one of its principal interests was India. And when we talk about India, we've got to remember that at this time we're talking about Bangladesh and Pakistan and Sri Lanka. The whole of that area was determined by the British as India. And it was a country which Britain quite bluntly exploited. It took raw materials from India, brought them back to Britain, manufactured them into goods like shirts and garments and cloths and so on, and then, believe it or not, resold them back to India and prevented India creating its own independent economy in these areas, preventing people actually developing the country. So Britain acquired a great deal of wealth from its exploitation of India. So it was an important part of the empire. And critical to this was the Suez Canal, which had been opened in the 19th century and was the gateway from the Mediterranean through into the Indian Ocean, through which the traffic went. You know, the vessels, more than half of the world's vessels, merchant navy vessels, which carried goods and materials, was actually British. It flew under, it sailed under the British flag. The Suez Canal was absolutely critical from the point of view of the British economy. Indeed, one commentator described it as the carotid artery of the British Empire. In other words, it was a vital channel. So the Suez Canal, India, these were critical parts of that. And in addition to that, at this time, although it's kind of little commented about, in my view, not sufficiently, there was the development of oil as a factor. So you had the British Navy, for example, in 1912, transferring its ships from being coal-fired, using coal, which of course was acquired in Britain, in the coal fields in Britain, and transferring that over to oil. And that had a big impact in terms of, from a military perspective, the range that those vessels could travel and also the way in which they were crewed. The British cabinet in 1917 discussed these issues and decided that that Palestine, being where it was at the eastern end of the Mediterranean, close to the Suez Canal, close to the developing oil fields in Mesopotamia, which is now Iraq, it would be a good place in which the British could establish their interests. So their views, if you like, coincided and converged with Zionist aspirations to go to Palestine. And so the British decided to act as, if you like, the guardians or the endorsers of this project, because it coincided, it converged with their interests. And the British established, to move on more quickly, after the First World War in 1917, the British took over what they call the Mandate, but essentially it was the British rule of Palestine as a colony throughout the 1920s. And throughout this time, despite the fact the population of Palestine was in the region of 80, 90% Palestinian Arab, that is Muslims and Christians, and only 10% or around about 10% Jewish, and of course that Jewish population not all being Zionists, as I'd explained, the British ruled that, but in a way which increasingly gave preference to those Zionists who came to Palestine for the creation of a Jewish state. And this involved a number of things. In the first place, it involved denying the Palestinians the right to self-determination. And there were many congresses that took place, Palestinian congresses, which gathered together representatives of the Palestinian people and decided Put forward policies about how they would like to become an independent state. They put those to the British on many occasions, but they were completely ignored. As a result of that, to concertina the story, in the 1930s, there was a massive uprising by the Palestinians from 1936 to 39, which was violently suppressed by the British. I think it was getting on for a third of the British Army, who was not based in India. A third of the British Army was deployed to Palestine to suppress that that strike and that uprising. And it involved the most brutal and vicious suppression of Palestinians, including quite literally the decimation of the male population of some villages where which were proximate to struggles or battles that had taken place in which the Palestinian uprising had engaged with the British forces. So that process culminated in 1939 in the defeat of the Palestinians, and that included more or less the disarming of the Palestinians. And at the same time that that was happening, the British encouraged and cooperated with and coordinated with Zionist paramilitary forces who were growing and expanding in the 1930s. And when it came to the post-war situation from 1944-45 onwards through to 1948, those forces became dominant in the country, had a great deal of latitude from the British to operate. And it was as a result of that in 1948 that you got whole-scale attack by these armed forces, the Haganah, the Stern Gang, as it was called, and so on. Carrying out quite literally terrorist actions, terrifying the people and resulting in the driving out of Palestinians up to three quarters of a million, 750,000, which was a large proportion of the population, and in what is called by the Palestinians the Nakba, or the catastrophe, the moment at which they were driven, literally driven out of their homes, and whole villages were attacked. So you had atrocities carried out at places like Deir Yassin, with hundreds of Palestinians massacred as a result of actions by the Zionist paramilitaries, which obviously then spread quite literally terror throughout the country and resulted in this evacuation. So that was really the turning point when it led to the forced eviction of Palestinians from their homes and to the presumption by the Zionist forces of statehood and the establishment of the State of Israel. And of course, there are many subsequent developments which reinforce that process, like, for example, the destruction of more than 500 villages and towns that belonged to, or that were not belonged to, but were Palestinian Arab places, which were destroyed subsequent to that and were built on, or in some cases turned into so-called natural parks and reservations and things of that kind.
Thank you. That's a really good explanation. 1967, of course, there is a war that involves Israel moving into and encroaching on far larger parts of the territory of what there was left of Palestine. Could we kind of say a little bit about what the detail of that? Is that doable?
It's not a period that I'm as familiar with as the early part and up to 1948, but certainly what happened in 1967 led to a second wave of refugees being created by the actions of the Israeli forces. And these refugees were essentially driven into areas of what is now the West Bank and East Jerusalem and in Gaza. So in those areas, you have refugee camps, people who have been internally displaced. And if you go to a refugee camp like Aida, a refugee camp outside of Bethlehem, you find written on the wall the names of all the towns and villages from which those refugees had been expelled in 1967. So this was a second. So you had two colossal waves of refugees, the refugees who were expelled in 1948, and then the second wave in 1967. What happened in 1967 was that eventually a ceasefire was brought about, and a green line, as they call it, was drawn around the West Bank, which was meant to delineate the area which would remain entirely Palestinian, and would draw a line between that and what had then become, of course, the State of Israel. And that green line is the line that most people think of when they think of talking about a two-state solution, that green line demarcates that. And it's a line, and this is sort of significant, if you like, which goes through the area of East Jerusalem, so that is meant to be part of what are called the final status negotiations to determine what might constitute the element. I mean, we'll come on to talk about this, but what might constitute the two states that exist. But since then, of course, what has happened has been the expansion of the settlements, a colossal expansion, which has led to, its estimates vary, but possibly in excess of 600,000-700,000 Israeli Jewish citizens in settlements which are now built within the West Bank. In other words, on what is notionally the Palestinian side of the Green Line. And these, when people talk about settlements, people might have a picture in their head of something that's temporary, can be taken down and moved, etc. They're not. These are towns. These are huge towns like Maal Adamin and so on, which have 60, 70, 80,000 people living in them. They are very large conurbations. They have their own unique roads, which are only for the settlers, which link them like an umbilical cord from the West Bank into Israel proper. Palestinians are not allowed to travel on them except with exceptional permits, and they are not easily acquired and don't happen very often. So they are separate roads for the settlers from those settlements into Israel itself. That has led to now the notion that the West Bank exists as a distinct area shaped off from the State of Israel is really now largely fictional. What has happened is that there's been the building of these huge settlement blocks. There's been the creation of industrial zones, in some case kind of on the border with the Green Line, which they've developed industries and so on. And whole swathes of the West Bank have been taken over. So, for example, more or less the whole of the Jordan Valley is now under the control of Israel. And that's in a very, very important area because it's a very fertile agricultural area, which previously had been a place in which, you know, Palestinian agriculture had been developed for the production of dates and all kinds of products. And that's happened. A recent report, I think it was 2013, 2014, by the West Bank, by the World Bank, had said that if the Jordan Valley was returned to the Palestinians, and if tourism was allowed to re-emerge and develop, and if they had control over the chemical industry, which is built up around the Dead Sea, then the economy of the West Bank would increase by something, its GDP would increase by something like 38%. So what happened in 1967 is directly linked now to the development of a Palestinian economy and a Palestinian state. And so what 67 meant was really the creation of a huge area of the West Bank. But then subsequent to that, we've seen that completely eroded. And it's now, if you look at it on the map, it's much like a sort of a series of islands, archipelagos that are dotted around the West Bank area.
So going forward a little more now, in our quick history, there are two intifadas, uprisings, as we might call them, one in the 80s and one in the early 2000s. Finally, when Palestinian people have just, they've had enough and they just decide they can't operate under this anymore. And there's been quite a few events recently. For instance, about a year or so ago now, there was the attempt for a great return home, a completely peaceful march by Palestinian people to go back to their lands of origin, which was met with brutal suppression by the Israelis. Is there a kind of anything to kind of help people maybe understand a little bit more about this, and then I suppose what the position is of Gaza now, and how Gaza and the West Bank are actually, they're split up really, aren't they? They're geographically not really connected.
Completely. I've been to both the West Bank and to Gaza, and you have to travel through Israel, and it's like going through borders. You have to show your ID. You have to, as you would going into any other nation state. But of course, people can't travel. People cannot travel from the West Bank to Gaza. It's just completely prohibited. The people who can travel in and out, particularly at this moment in time, are very restricted numbers of people for very prescribed reason. For example, in the past, Palestinians suffering from cancer were able to travel from Gaza into Israel to get treatment because they don't have the provisioning in Gaza to do that, to look after patients with cancer, particular forms of cancer. But now they can't. They just can't travel from that area. So, you know, in the recent events that we've seen with the bombings that have taken place, you've seen people with illnesses just not being treated and not being able to get treatment. So, you know, it is an extremely difficult situation. It's one in which, as I described, the idea that there could be a Palestinian state under the present circumstances, which could live side by side with Israel, is really largely fictional because the Israelis themselves have destroyed that. It's not contiguous. In other words, in the first place, Gaza and West Bank are separated physically, but even more so now with the, as I was describing, the penetration and growth of huge settlement areas within the West Bank, the appropriation of the Jordan Valley and of other parts of the West Bank as either nature reserves or as military reserves and firing zones. So in the South Hebron Hills, for example, there are large parts of that which are designated as military zones in which no one can enter. And there are in all sorts of ways the West Bank is completely and utterly fragmented. So the uprisings that you've talked about in the past had as their objective, if you like, the assertion of the rights of the Palestinians to self-determination and the creation of a Palestinian state. What is now really increasingly coming up for debate is whether that is viable any longer. And there have been two very, very important reports which have come out literally this year. One by an Israeli NGO called B'Tselem, which is a very reputable, respected Israeli NGO, and the other by Human Rights Watch, which internationally is known for its record on issues of human rights and so on. And both of those have come out with the statement that in their view, what is taking place now is akin to apartheid, and that this is, if one looks at the United Nations definitions of what constitutes apartheid, they believe that it's appropriate now to begin to talk about Israel as an apartheid state, one in which both the treatment of the Palestinians within the West Bank, East Jerusalem and Gaza, and this is what is significant, the treatment of Palestinians within the state of Israel itself constitute a level of discrimination based on ethnicity, which is akin to the way in which in South Africa, where the term derives from, that the black majority in South Africa were treated by the white minority ruling class.
I was just kind of hoping for the audience to understand a little bit, because they might be familiar with something about the Oslo Accords or anything. And although I think that's a show in itself, so I'm not going to hit you with just explaining all that today. I think it's a bit much. But they did talk about dividing parts of the West Bank into different sectors, A, B and C, I believe it is, and how those are governed. And when I was there, I found it, at the time, really quite difficult to understand. I understood it wasn't very good, but beyond that, I couldn't really understand because they had kind of split it up, so it was under kind of different control in each different sector, which made the whole thing just infeasible. It couldn't be run. Nobody could run anything like that. And I just thought that that's worth just a few words on that, because it's a good example to anyone who's listening of the, I think, lack of seriousness that Israel has ever had about any kind of real power being given to the Palestinians. I mean, I don't think they need to be, and that's, we'll come on to that in a minute. But the attitude is kind of, it's almost, quite frankly, like a very unpleasant piss take. But if you're in area A, you're not really properly connected to area B, and area C is run by something else. Is there anything? Yeah, I mean, you can maybe explain it a bit more articulately than I'm able to.
Well, the three categories, you're quite right. The three categories were meant to define areas which were would eventually meld into one and become one whole West Bank. The area A was meant to be areas which were those which were entirely under the control of the Palestinians. Allegedly, cities like Nablus and Ramallah were meant to be wholly governed by the Palestinians, and Palestinian law would function in those areas. Area B were those areas in which there was meant to be some kind of dual process in which the Israeli military could enter and could operate, but which were notionally under the control of the Palestinians. And Area C were those areas that were entirely under the control of Israel. And there was meant to be a timescale within which this would translate into one single unit, and there would not be these differences. But what has happened in reality, as you say, is quite rightly, is that it's become absolutely rigidly applied, and the areas which are designated as Area A are a very tiny proportion of the West Bank. The West Bank and Gaza constitutes, I think it's, I may be wrong in this, but somewhere around about 20-odd% of the whole of what we call historic Palestine. Historic Palestine is all of those occupied areas that we are talking about, plus the State of Israel. In other words, what Palestine looked like back prior to 1948. And the West Bank and Gaza constitute around about 20%, 22% of that area of historic Palestine. And then within that, what is Area A within the West Bank now constitutes less than 50% of the West Bank itself. So it's the Palestinian controlled areas are diminished completely. And that's the reality of it. The eminent Palestinian intellectual Edward Said described the Oslo Accords, which were adopted in the 1990s and meant to, if you like, foreshadow the process that would lead to the establishment of two states. He described it as the Palestinian Versailles. In other words, he compared it to what happened in the 1920s when the world imperial powers divided up the world between themselves and as a result, as we know, led to eventually laying the basis for what was the Second World War with the way in which Germany was treated. And he said that, you know, that Oslo was a kind of a, if you like, a redivision of Palestine in the same way in which the world had been divided up in the 1920s. And that is the truth, tragically. It has led not to a process which has generated a momentum towards the creation of a single state, but has really led to the further diminution of areas that were under Palestinian control. And of course, one of the parts of the resolution of the creation of a Palestinian state would have had to be an element that is neglected completely, but has become now to be put back on the agenda. And that is the right of return of those refugees, as I described earlier at the beginning of our talk, who in 1948 were expelled. Not only they moved to areas like Gaza and to the West Bank and East Jerusalem, but some of them left the area of historic Palestine completely and went to seek refuge in Jordan or in Syria or in Lebanon or in Egypt and left that area. And there are many millions of Palestinian refugees, some of whom left in 1948. Some of them are the children of those refugees. And quite literally, some of them still carrying with them the keys for their front doors, which is the symbol of the Palestinian refugees. And the right of return and the right of the refugees is something which has been completely neglected, but has to be reinserted and re-understood by people internationally as a key component of the resolution of the situation. The right for the Palestinian people to self-determination requires a resolution of the issue of the rights of Palestinian refugees as well.
Going forward, let's go into Palestinian solidarity. So here in Britain, we have a Palestine solidarity campaign. That's a very open and supportive organisation. There are similar ones wherever else you might go in different parts of the world. What do you think can be best achieved by us internationally? What kind of support can we offer? And just to give people some idea, I'm sure they're aware of this, but somehow Israel seems to have, generally speaking, far better international support, certainly mainstream political support. What do we think is the reasons for this? And it still seems quite difficult to offer solidarity to Palestine without certain... But I'm being very kind in the way I'm explaining this, the way certain political actors will try and complicate the situation. I'd say deeply disingenuous political actors, but that's another story. How best do you think we could kind of sum that up or explain it? Power of international solidarity for Palestinians, but also the hurdle we have to overcome with support for Israel.
Well, I often use the analogy of talking about South Africa and the campaign against apartheid in South Africa. And I think there were three major components to that. One was, and centrally, and that was the resistance of the anti-apartheid fighters inside South Africa itself and the mass campaign that they developed, the welding together of forces like the trade union movement, the student movement, the movement in the rural areas and in the urban areas. And that was a huge and colossal force within South Africa. But accompanied with that, the South African anti-apartheid movement called for international solidarity. And central to that was the boycott campaign, which they called for, which led to internationally countries eventually under pressure from the people who lived in those countries being forced to take a position of not trading with South Africa. Interestingly, Israel was one of the countries that kept on trading with South Africa, including in the arms trade. And the third component to that was, of course, a recognition within South Africa by the white, essentially the white minority ruling class, that they could no longer go on as they had. Now, I think if you take those three components and look at them in relation to the Palestinian struggle, clearly there is a Palestinian resistance which is there, which is, as the Palestinians say, is steadfast in its resistance against what is taking place. We are part of building that international solidarity, and I think that's critical to that, and we can talk perhaps about boycott in a moment, but that is a central part of that. But the third part is that the ruling class within Israel have not really come to a conclusion that they cannot go on as they have done in the past without making some recognition and acknowledgement and coming to terms with negotiating with the Palestinians for a way of respecting Palestinian right to self-determination. And I think that's largely because on the international field, as you're really indicating, Israel, the Israeli government, and we can see this in the negotiations that are going on at the moment over who will form the next government in Israel. We've seen, you know, Netanyahu trying to cling on to office and other people trying to form a government. The reason that they act in this way and feel they can act with impunity is behind them, they have the support of the United States. Absolutely colossal support. And it's not just kind of political support, it's material support. Israel gets billions, literally billions of dollars from the United States in support. It has had 10-year contracts in which the United States has supplied money for arms and for armaments for Israel. And I think this is tied up with, and this is a much bigger subject, but of course it's tied up with the United States' interest in the Middle East as a whole, and it wants Israel to be able to act as a gendarme, as a police officer in the Middle East to suppress Arab uprisings and Arab struggles and striving for independence against the reactionary regimes in Saudi Arabia and Egypt and Syria and so on. And the United States does not want this to happen. Saudi Arabia remains, as I talked about at the very beginning, an incredibly important source for the oil. Iraq remains an important source of an oil. The United States does not have vast oil reserves, although it is one of the major producers of oil. So it's control over that. And in a way, just for a moment, we could say that's reflected in their attitude to Venezuela, which is also one of the world's largest oil reserves. So the attitude of the Americans is tied up with their aspirations and ambitions and desires and wishes in the Middle East as a whole, I think. And that is why you see them wanting to back Israel, because I'm of the belief, it may be deemed slightly naive by some people, but I think an independent Palestinian state would be democratic. It would be a very progressive force in the Middle East, and would have would set a new and different model for the kind of regimes that have existed. You know, you can imagine Egypt. Egypt has more than 100 million people in it. A progressive Egypt with its people controlling the resources of the land and its territory would have a big resonance throughout the rest of the Middle East area, as would an Iraq, which was independent and was developing its economy in the interests of the people of Iraq. So I think it's not too far fetched to say that I think that the Israeli government and the Israeli actions of the Israeli government and their confidence in the way in which they act is tied up with the fact that at the back of them, they feel they have the United States, has a material interest in retaining the status quo, in not allowing for the creation and development of an independent Palestinian state, because of the messages that that would send to other parts of the Arab world. And we saw in the Arab uprising some years ago the potential for dramatic changes across the whole of the Middle East area, with the uprising in Tunisia, in Egypt, and so on and so forth, which gave us a momentary vision of a new Arab world. And I think that is something that is, it's not too far-fetched to say that the United States would not wish to see happen.
Yeah, and I think that's an incredibly good point for a number of reasons. When you have the argument, or I've had arguments with people in regards how much of the business of the rest of the world it is what Israel does, I know sometimes in Israel they like to tell people to butt out, to which I usually say, well, then return all of the money you got from America to its taxpayers, return all of the weapons that this country has sold you. Because if this country, for instance, that I happen to live in, and beyond that, I don't have any great connection to it. But nevertheless, if it happens to be selling arms to Israel, happens to send them to Burma, Myanmar, happens to be selling them to Saudi Arabia, I consider that my business, very much so. So that's always my, just a slight side issue there. That's always a point I have to people. This international situation doesn't necessarily have anything to do with us. I disagree. I think it has something to do with all of us. Have you ever encountered the subject of Palestine, Israel, in the classroom? Have you had any problems bringing it up, or has it never been a problem?
Well, it's a very hot topic at the moment, because it has become an issue. I've been retired from teaching for a number of years, but I've been invited into schools to talk about Palestine and Israel. And, that have been very interesting, and students have been very interested in the issue and concerned about the topic and questioning, and rightfully so, have been challenging. And I think it is important that and at this point in time, there are many students and young people, and you can see it from social media and from other kind of evidence that there is a very widespread interest in this country in what is taking place and what is happening. I think it's important, clearly, that we explain to students, and the students kind of come to understand that there is a world of difference between making political assessments and analysis and understandings of a situation, and particularly this situation in Palestine and Israel, and the issue of anti-Semitism, and explaining that when we're talking about Israel, we're talking about a state, we're talking about a government, we're talking about an army, we're talking about a military and a court system, which is belongs to that nation. And this is something very different from the kind of anti-Semitism where people think that all Jews are responsible for what happens in Israel, and therefore all Jews are can be targets. And we see, and we have seen, and it is a tragedy, but it is true, and we need to say it out loud. We have seen evidence of anti-Semitism being expressed by people. And in some cases, this is a genuine confusion and failure to understand. But in other cases, it is, of course, a continuation of anti-Semitism, which has been particularly prevalent in Europe and was manifestly evident in the tragedy of the Holocaust and the actions of Nazi Germany in the 1930s and 40s. So it is something that really has to be dealt with. And there are rightfully sensitivities and understandings that need to be taken on board in conducting that. And recently, it's come up as an issue, and there have been some incidents which are, show the ignorance, in my view, and I don't say that in a pejorative form with the intention of insulting, but a genuine lack of knowledge is what I mean by ignorance, on the part of teachers as well as perhaps on the part of some students. For example, I know that there are incidents that have occurred in schools where some teachers have said that flying the Palestinian flag is anti-Semitic. Now, you know, they clearly do not understand the right for self-determination and the significance of national symbols for people as an identity. That is something very, very different from the kind of anti-Semitism that, you know, that we have seen, that we saw in Germany and we have seen in parts of Eastern Europe. So I think those are things that need to be dealt with. But this is ignorance or lack of knowledge, lack of understanding. And the common retort is that, well, you know, this is a complex issue. We can't discuss it. There are two sides to this. And of course, that's completely wrong. The whole point about education is to try to develop an understanding and appreciation. And if there are two sides, to evaluate those. I mean, it's ironic because I can remember back in the 1980s, the 1970s, friends of mine teaching in school about apartheid. And some of the management within the school said they shouldn't talk about it because it was political and there were two sides. No one would ever say that now. You know, people would say, of course, there might be two points of view, but these are not equal sides. Same is true with the situation in Palestine. The fact that there are different points of view doesn't mean to say you shouldn't engage with it. I would argue it's even more reason. More reason to talk about it, not less. We all need to develop an understanding and an appreciation and a sympathy for that. I mean, for example, let's take the case of anti-Semitism. One of the things that happened in the 1930s is that actually when Jews were trying to leave Germany and to escape what was happening in Eastern Europe, it was the United States of America, it was Britain, it was Australia, it was Canada, who put up obstacles to refugees trying to find, you know, havens. The British required people to be able to bring certain amounts of money. They required them to give evidence of levels of education, of transferable skills, which they could use and employ. And the same happened in America. They put obstacles in the way of Jews escaping. So these are truths which people don't want to talk about. The anti-Semitism that was prevalent in places like Britain, in places like the United States, in places like Australia and Canada, that led to Jews being unable to escape the pogroms that were happening in Eastern Europe. And these things need to be dealt with as well.
What that makes me think of is when if you're going to be fobbing off your pupils or especially, you know, younger people in an education system by saying, it's a bit complicated, you don't really want to think about it. I say it's a pretty shit education system.
Teachers are aware of it. I mean, and in the best of cases, what I'm very pleased about is my own union, the National Education Union, which is has 500,000 members and is the biggest education union in Europe, is sensitive to that and has produced guidelines for teachers on teaching controversial subjects. And it did this during the Iraq war because students were raising questions about why was Britain participating in a war, you know, many thousands of miles away in conjunction with the United States of America. And they wanted to ask questions about it. And the union took the view that rather than try to prevent this happening, or to say it's too complicated to understand, the union developed guidelines which helped teachers manage and handle discussions within the classroom that enabled students to ask questions and to gain an understanding. And I'm very pleased to say that it's reissued that, so that teachers have a framework within which they can discuss these issues, and that people can ask questions, you know, with respect and with appreciation and understanding, and gain an understanding of it. And I think that's what should happen. That's the way in which it should be dealt with. But you're seeing in some instances a suppression of that discussion, which is wholly negative and anti-educational, but you're seeing expanded into the academic field inside universities. You're seeing, you know, people who allegedly, because they take a line of support for the Palestinians and the right of the Palestinians to self-determination, it is presumed by others that this is anti-Semitic. And of course, there are many, we point out and constantly present the case that there are many Jewish supporters of the Palestinians. You know, in Britain, there is Jewish Voice for Labour, there is Jews for Justice for Palestinians, there is Jews Against Zionism. In the United States of America, there is a very big Jewish constituency campaigning for Palestinian rights. So the idea that this is kind of one-sided and that those who support the Palestinian rights are anti-Semitic, I think is something to be repudiated and rejected. It is actually permeating in different areas of British society, such that you are having definitions of what constitutes anti-Semitism promoted, which try to conflate criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism, and conflate criticism of Zionist politics and the politics of Zionism with being anti-Semitic, and they are quite distinct and quite different. And it's very, very important to say that. I mean, and you know, I have said to people on many occasions, there are Zionists who are not Jews, and there are Jews who are not Zionists. There is in the United States of America, amongst the Christians, sections of the Christian community, which is very pro-Zionist and very supportive of the state. There are many Jews who are not Zionist real and opposed to the way in which it acts towards the Palestinians. And it's a much more complex issue than to make out.
I quite agree. What I'd also raise, the Free Speech Brigade, they don't seem to have anything to say about this.
The right of freedom of speech, progressive forces, you know, true, going back into the 19th century, if you look at the right of, in Britain, the right of the Chartists fighting for the right to vote, if you look at the suffragettes, you know, and so forth, it's been people with progressive ideas who want to enhance democracy, who have been the people at the forefront of defending freedom of speech. And this appropriation by some sections of the right of the idea that they are champions of freedom of speech is a complete, you know, falsehood. It's completely wrong narrative. What they really mean is the right to express bigotry, prejudice, and not be accused of being bigots or being prejudiced. Of course, that's something altogether. Freedom of speech doesn't mean a license for people with reactionary views like racists or fascists to be unchallenged. It means something quite different from that.
I mean, that's really fundamental. We've discussed this so often on this show. I think it's really fundamental to the idea of what you're really dealing with on the right at this present time. It's people who, as you say, want to be able to express not only their truly appalling and defeated, let's be honest, defeated views about the world, but also want to do it in the confines of the very kind of safe spaces that they constantly accuse the left of wanting. They don't want to be criticised. They don't want to be challenged even. They don't want anyone to kind of have an alternative view. They're just basically loudmouth bullying bores at the front of the pub, trying to force everyone to think what they think.
Yeah, I think that you know, this has become a fairly major debate, and it does link into what we're talking about Palestine very much, because it's been issues like the definition of what constitutes anti-Semitism that have been, if you like, the issues that have come in on this. And we have at the present point in time an announcement by the British government that it intends to introduce legislation about freedom of speech. And I think we have to be very much on our guard about what that actually means. and how they're going to define it and how they're going to express it, because we've got a whole series of measures that are being introduced in the laws in Britain around the police crime and criminal sentencing, which threaten the right to demonstrate. And for example, there's a proposal in that if a demonstration is deemed to be a nuisance, it's too noisy or it's deemed to be inconvenient, then the police have the right to prevent that demonstration taking place or that demonstration happening. So this right about freedom of speech will link into the whole question of what is permitted and what is not permitted. And it's something we need to be vigilant about in terms of what the government is proposing. And there are demonstrations taking place in Britain, not only in support of the Palestinians, but against these kind of constraints which threaten the legitimacy and the ability to have these discussions about issues like Palestine, as we are doing now.
That's a hugely important point. I suppose, kind of looking for a conclusion for this week's episode, I always talk at the end of any show about going forward. Now, what's interesting at the time that we're recording this is it's the day after it looks as if Mr. Netanyahu is going to finally see the end of his political career, certainly as far as his dominance of Israeli politics is concerned. However, the group that are looking to replace him are, to say they're possibly to the right of him is putting it mildly. Now, the only time Israeli politics ever interests me is in what reference it has to Palestinian people. So where do you think, bearing in mind for everything we've talked about over the last hour, for the Palestinian people, for international solidarity with Palestinians, etc., and not to put you too much on the spot here, but where do you think we might go next with all of this?
Well, I'd certainly think that the question of international solidarity is extremely important. The Palestinian boycott, disinvestment and sanctions campaign launched by the Boycott National Committee is endorsed by all major civil society, NGO bodies in Palestine, and is something which is really gaining attention and gaining traction. And I think that's very, very important. A couple of weeks ago in London, as you know, there was a major demonstration on the streets of London, which it's estimated there were up to 200,000 people present, which is one of the largest demonstrations since the Iraq war that we have seen on the streets of London. And I was sending photographs back to friends in Palestine and friends in Israel, and they were absolutely elated and pleased with seeing these things, and it gave them heart and gave them impetus. And there has been since that calls for, you know, continuing support from the trade unions in Palestine, for example, who had called a general strike, that we show some kind of solidarity and manifestation in support of them whenever we can, when those events happen. So I think we can't underestimate the importance of the international campaign. What you say about Israel and Israeli politicians, I completely agree with. As one friend of mine once described in a different political context, the choice between two groups of people as the choice between Tweedledum and Tweedledummer. In other words, there was nothing to put between them, not even a cigarette paper. I think it is very difficult. There is on the horizon no evidence of any substantial political force within the country of Israel, which actually has the view that it wants to negotiate some kind of way forward with the Palestinians. I don't think that is there. There are oppositionists within Israel, and by oppositionists, I mean Jewish oppositionists as well as Palestinians who live within the state of Israel, who express opposition. But one has to concede that from the point of view of the Jewish community within Israel, it's a very small proportion. They're very courageous, and they're very forthright, and they are people to be admired and to be given support to. People like the Women's Coalition for Peace, or people like Zokrot, or people like Breaking the Silence, soldiers who are giving testimony to the appalling actions that the Israeli army has taken in the past and is taking now at the present. So there is evidence of that, and there are sections of Israeli society. Within Israeli society, there's also, of course, the Palestinians, who constitute 20% of the population, have representatives within parliament. But I think you're right to say that there is no immediate prospect of a political emergence of even a substantial current in opposition that wants to see changes. So I think that the international campaign is vital to that. But a part of me also thinks that that was the case in South Africa. You know, in South Africa, the apartheid supporters carried on. And then it seemed almost, not overnight, because clearly things were happening, but there was this kind of shattering of this kind of monolith, and that it happened quite quickly. And I think that I don't hold this out as an immediate prospect, but I think that changes can take place quickly. I don't at this moment think that that is very likely. By that, I mean for the next 5 or 10 years, I don't, but who knows how these things happen. But I think there will be a change, and there will have to come a time where there have to be a recognition that Israel cannot go on living as it is living, treating the Palestinians as it is treating them. And I think that there will be a fracture that will take place. What needs to happen, of course, is the creation of a more unified Palestinian political perspective, brings together the whole of the Palestinian society, Palestinian national identity, which brings together the Palestinians not only of the West Bank, of East Jerusalem and of Gaza, but the Palestinians of the refugee camps and the Palestinians of the diaspora to speak with a unified voice in seeking to bring about that change. And there are processes that obviously will need to take place for that to come about. But I think that's why I think the international campaigning is critically important, in order to give Palestinians an understanding that it is possible, and that there are people who support them, and that they're not alone, and that this is not something which they have to fight on their own. I remain an optimist in it, although I recognize at this moment in time, we are in a very difficult situation, or the Palestinians are in a very, very difficult situation, and that it won't happen in the short term. But Israeli society is not monolithic. It is, you know, there are different components to it, but we can't see them. We don't see those fissures at the moment. We don't see those breaks. But I think there will come a recognition that on the part of sections of Israeli society, that they cannot go on treating the Palestinians as they are treating them. And in those moments, I think we can see the potential for changes.
Bernard, thank you so much for being on All the Rage. Obviously, we are in total solidarity with the Palestinian people. And I really thank you for sharing your knowledge on this subject. It's one that I can never get educated enough about.
Thanks very much indeed, Jonathan.
All the Rage with John Bowd. www.traxfm.org